My name is Terry Thornton. I'm curator of education, and I'm really happy to welcome you to Tuesday Evenings at the Modern. Tuesday Evenings is a weekly series for anybody who's new. And next week we have Robin O'Neill, artist who's now living in California and whose monumental drawing, These Final Hours, and that is a very much an abbreviation of her title. But we didn't have time tonight for me to include the entire title. That drawing was acquired as part of our 10 acquisitions for our 10th year anniversary in this building, and it is currently on the second floor. You can see it up there. It's quite an undertaking and monumental in that it marks a shift in her work as well. So she'll be here next week to talk about her work. Tonight we have with us, and those of you who know my introductions, these are very brief introductions of each individual because throughout the night you're going to really get to know them, and I don't want to use too much time. We have Ariel Evans, who is the founder and editor of Pastelogram magazine, which she began and continues to run while also working on her PhD in art history at the University of Texas, Austin, and as this year's curatorial fellow at UT's Visual Arts Center. Many of you may know Ariel from her previous position as the assistant editor for Art Lies, and we're very happy to have Ariel here with us tonight. We also have participating tonight Alexander Provan, editor of Triple Canopy, a magazine and editorial collective based in New York, LA, and Berlin. In addition to his work with Triple Canopy, Alexander is a contributing editor to the Biden, a magazine covering the Middle East with an educational and curatorial focus. His writing has appeared in The Nation, The Believer, N Plus One, Book Forum, Art Forum, and Freeze, among other publications. And Triple Canopy has recently participated in exhibitions and organized public programs at the Museum of Modern Art, New York, the Museum of Contemporary Art in Denver, where I believe they're part of a current exhibition, and MoMA PS1, and Artisma 18. And finally, we have with us Sina Najafi, who is editor-in-chief of Cabinet Magazine and the editorial director of Cabinet Books. In addition to his vast duties, and as I understand it, he is the footing and backbone of Cabinet Magazine. In addition to those duties, Sina has curated and co-curated a number of exhibitions, including Philosophical Toys for Apex Art in 2005, the Museum of Projective Personality Testing for Manifesta 7 in 2008, Odd Lots, Revisiting Gorda Mata Clark's Fake Estates for White Columns in Queens Museum of Art in 2005. And then there's the traveling exhibition, The Paper Sculpture Show, from 2003 to 2007. Sina has taught at Cooper Union, Yale, and RISD, and studied comparative literature at Princeton, Columbia, and NYU. So we're very happy to have all three with us tonight, and I'm going to give you just briefly, before then we show them a warm welcome, I'm just going to give you my purpose or impetus for this panel. My email invite to each of these guys for tonight's panel, of course it was specific to each one, but generally I said something like, I am hoping to put together a panel on the vibrant life and perceived challenges of today's art publication. The impetus for this invitation is a true regard for your organization as an extraordinary effort that seems to have determined a need and gone beyond expectations and conventions to offer a product that teases, instructs, mystifies, and stimulates readers, viewers, and participants. And then I said, now, if you can still take me seriously after that. But in fact, I really was quite sincere about that. I'm very enthusiastic about tonight's panel, and I'm looking at our audience, and it's spare in number, but it's enormous in quality. I know most of you who are sitting out there, and I happen to know very much why you're here And I'm happy to do this for you and for me. As many of you have heard me say, I feel like this is a very timely conversation to be had with what I know to be very experienced and wildly creative people at a particularly charged time of collaborative efforts and artist-writer initiatives here in the DFW area. As we are all looking for affirmation, camaraderie, and perhaps some direction. So hopefully my instincts were good, and all will be achieved tonight in this panel. We will begin by with an abbreviated, and I mean really abbreviated, because we could, of course, have a lecture by each one of these people individually, but tonight they're going to give a very abbreviated presentation of each of their publications, and then we'll move into a discussion which will end, thanks to tonight's exceptional audience, with a very lively Q&A, so I want you all to be thinking about your questions. And then we're going to make every effort, I promise, to be, conclude at 8:30 for a lot of reasons. So if you would now, let's get started. Please join me in welcoming Sina, Alex, and Eric. Okay, and at this point, we're going to turn it over to Sina, and then after Sina, Ariel will present Pastelgram, and then Alexander will talk to us about Triple Canopy. So, Sina, are you ready?
I am.
All right.
Oh, he's going to start me on the five-minute thing.
Okay. Oh, okay. All right, look at that. Pros.
Uh-oh. We're already off. There we go. Okay. So just some nuts and bolts to begin with. The magazine was started in 1999 as a nonprofit. We're based in Brooklyn, New York. And our space now is also a place where we do events and performances. And we also put out books. So that's sort of the shorthand of what we actually do. Each issue of the magazine has a section that's themed. And the themes go back and forth between the preposterously huge and the ridiculously tiny, and from the very philosophically recognizable themes like evil to ones that seem to have no grasp on the world as such. So here's an issue we did, for example, on friendship, issue on bubbles, issue on shame. We like these themes that are sort of to the side of the big themes in philosophy, so not guilt, for example, but shame as a political affect. Shadows, islands, the enemy, the hardest issue we've ever done. Testing, dust, learning, the average, which is really about mediocrity, the history of the idea of mediocrity. And just to go back to that image that you saw to begin with, I want to just kind of retroactively produce two kinds of mission statements for the magazine. I kind of think all mission statements are retroactive. Like when you jump in, you have no idea what you're doing. You have a little bit of a better idea later on after 12 years, but not really. Mm-hmm. So I'm glad we have a five-minute limit, because that's my alibi for never really fully telling you what we do. If I had infinite amount of time, I still couldn't do it. But so this is the shield that we created in 2008 when we moved into our current space. And it's a mishmash or an amalgam or a synthesis, depending how nice or unnice you want to be about toward what we've done here, of a bunch of different philosophical essays. So these two characters here, the fox and the hedgehog, are borrowed from an essay by Isaiah Berlin, the philosopher Isaiah Berlin. It's an essay on Tolstoy, where he starts to think about what kind of writer Tolstoy was, and he resuscitates an old Greek pre-Socratic fragment from Archilochus, the poet, where he talks about how hedgehogs know one big thing and foxes know many small things. And he goes to town, Isaiah Berlin does, with this distinction, and he teases out this distinction to mean something like, foxes cannot systematize. They dabble in lots of things, but there's no systematic way in which they can understand the world. And for him, someone like Shakespeare is a fox. And hedgehogs are people who have a system, and everything in some sense passes through the system. And for him, Dante, for example, would be a hedgehog, because everything passes through Christianity for him. And he plays this wonderful parlor game, if you're interested in these things, it's fantastic. He goes through every you've ever heard of, and he categorizes them here, there, here, there. Tolstoy turns out to be a very hard case because Tolstoy is somebody who thought he was a hedgehog, but was actually a fox. He misrecognized his own work. But what they are, there are two modes of knowledge, two ways of approaching the world. And as I said, this is all retroactive. At some point, we thought that these two modes of knowing the world, these two approaches, are things we're both interested in. We don't want to reject one in favor of the other, but we also want to have a magazine that puts them in tension with each other and places them right next to each other in ways that are, we hope, uncomfortable and don't always make sense to the reader or to us. So that's what that part of it is. And the bottom part here, this is Kant's motto for the Enlightenment in an essay that he wrote called What is Enlightenment, where he talks about how the Enlightenment is the motto of the Enlightenment is dare to know, which is what this translates as. And he says the Enlightenment is when you step out from childhood and you use your own reason. So that's what that is. And I'm not going to read this to you, because I see it's already 4 minutes and 33 seconds. And here's another sort of anecdote that we've used as a way of creating a mission statement. Again, as I said, all of this is fabricated retroactively. Don't tell the grant givers this. That's the only these are, of course, Mexican jumping beans. And in 1934, an incident happened that we wrote about in the magazine where there was a Christmas party and a whole number of intellectuals in Paris were at this Christmas party, and André Breton was there, Jacques Lacan was there, and Roger Caillois was also there. He's a young French writer who is incredibly precocious. He's 20, I think, 2 or 3 at the time, and everyone knows that Breton has anointed him to take over the Surrealist movement. He's the sort of heir. And somebody brings out these Mexican jumping beans, and then something incredible happens. Caillois says, "This is incredible. We should cut one up and see what's inside of it." And Breton says, "What kind of surrealist are you if you want to give up the beautiful, infinite poetry of guessing forever what's in there and making up scenarios in favor of the one mundane truth, which you think is that there's an insect inside?" That's what Caillois was venturing. And they had a huge fight, and Caillois lost. They did not cut open the bean. And the next day, Caillois left the Surrealist movement because of this incident and joined Bataille in the kind of the dark side of Surrealism. And he wrote this amazing letter, and I'll just read you a tiny part of it. It's like a 4-page letter, and you can find it in the Caillois Reader if you're interested in the whole letter. But he says, "For instance, modern atomic theory is at present an adventure into the dark. Here we have a form of the marvelous that does not fear knowledge, but on the contrary thrives on it. When I compare this great game with Gerard de Nerval's attitude, who refused to enter Palmyra so as not to spoil his preconceptions, or with your own, refusing to slice open a jumping bean that sometimes jolts about because you did not want to find an insect or a worm inside that would have destroyed the mystery, you said, my mind is made up to leave the movement. Actually, it always was. As a child, I could never really have fun with toys. I was constantly ripping them open or dismantling them to find out what they were like inside, how they worked." And he goes on to discuss how the marvelous is not in that mind of the person, but in the world, objectively in the world, and it's infinite. And if you open up the bean, it doesn't end up that you have one mundane answer, and there's a false dichotomy, he thinks, that Breton has between let's say, knowledge, scientific knowledge, let's say, and poetry. And he argues that, in fact, the two of them are part of the same knowledge. And it's a false distinction that makes us think that you want this or that. And at times, when we succeed, we try to approach this condition of thinking that the two of them do belong to each other in a way that cannot be ripped apart without doing injustice to each of those two halves. So that's sort of what we do. 18 seconds over.
No, stop timing.
Oh, you did.
Okay, Ariel is up next. I believe, is that right?
Yes.
Very good.
Okay. So first I wanted to mention that it's an honor to be here with Sheena and Alexander, since their publications have deeply inspired Pastelogram. What Pastelogram does is we publish print and online issues. These are our three print issues, each of which is devoted to a single body of work by an artist or curator. So, for example, our first online issue was by Christina Felix, where Felix worked with our web programmer to... she created these images on the right, the text box, and then, in this case, ladies' panties. And our programmer wrote a script that pulled Google's visually similar images. And over the course of the issues, she explored issues of emotion as it gets repeated over and over and over and over again in forum like the internet. So this is an artwork that could only be realized online and was indeed online. So Pastelogram kind of basically is a sort of site-specific project. Now, that's not particularly uncommon. And what is, I would like to think, common about Pastelogram is how we think about the text that we choose and edit to surround the words. Now, when we started this magazine 2 years ago, what we first thought was to showcase the work's sources. That is, the texts and ideas that informed the creation of the work, a kind of archive for the artist. So we collaborated with the artist to create such an archive to feature in our publication. And here's an example from our second print issue by Ricky Yannis, where what Ricky was doing was he was spoofing Time magazine, playing with the advertisements of Time, because he felt that the advertisements really structured the informational content of that magazine. So he was reading a lot of textbooks from advertising magazines, and we reprinted one in his issue, and you can see that here. In many ways, Pastelogram is about exploring artistic practice. And this idea for the ways in which we do so came out of a project I was working on at the time, which I thought might be interesting to mention here. I'm going to Pastelogram myself, really, in that I'm talking about the magazine's own sources of creation. So I was thinking about Joseph Cornell's issue of Americani Fantastica, made in 1942 but published in 1943. And I was trying to, I should mention I'm an art historian. You might have caught that. Anyway, so I was working on this. I was trying to deal with Cornell in a way that avoided what seemed very common readings of him at the time. Specifically, notions that Cornell was an untrained and eccentric window shopper who wandered around New York collecting beautiful things and arranging them in pretty ways. You can see that in the cover. There's many pretty things arranged in a pretty way. Museum catalogs and such would often talk about Cornell in a way that boils down to what I just said. But what I noticed about this issue, among other of Cornell's works, was a deeply intelligent structure of resonances that Cornell fit these pretty things into. For example, this is an insert that came into the magazine called The Crystal Cage, and on the left you see a word poem, and it's just a listing of words and names, each of which falls into categories such as ballerinas, stars in the sky, movie stars, gymnasts, old buildings, Renaissance artists, and so forth. And all of those are things that Cornell liked, that are commonly attributed to his work. Now, you can group these under certain types. These words in the poem are the list, depending on how you want to define it. But that actually becomes a little difficult because those words are spread out seemingly at random, and also many words actually fit two categories. So I have diagrammed out two categories here, and you'll see that there are repetitions. And you know, for example, the Berenice of the title, Berenice was actually a living person and the name of a constellation, so it fits in two ways. So not only does this notion of constellation appear in the title and listed among these words, but it's the undergirding structure for these pages. So if you actually look at the poem, the spaces between the words become a constellation visually, and then the silhouette of that lines up with the following page here on the left. So as you turn the page, you see the same silhouette, but now it's from the abstract word to the specific image. Of course, saying that, I should mention that the facing page on the left actually mimics the image in that there are eight registers and the verticals are emphasized along the bottom. So again, it's the system of resonances that Cornell set up as a way of moving from the specific to the very abstract, kind of vibrating between the two, to have one thing or one image be able to take on many meanings because of the possibilities of its connections with other content pieces. So this method of structuring images was very powerful to me as I began conceiving of Pastelogram, which I did right at the same time as working on this, in that what we try to do is have every essay or article or image be thought of as its own discrete thing, but also as being able to take that discrete thing, add more meaning onto it when juxtaposing it with other images or content in the magazine, or thinking about it as part of the magazine as a whole, or using it for some other project that the reader invents or comes up with. So that brings me back to the notion of sources, which I mentioned earlier, and which is to say that this idea of the showcasing this archive for the artist is kind of a half-truth, since obviously it's once you start publishing a magazine, it's not so easy. We have to cherry-pick what elements of the artist's sketchbook we want to use, so to speak, or sometimes in conversation, I know about something that I think works great for the work, and I want to put it in, and therefore it goes in, because I get my way. And so that's kind of how it works. But the calling it about but saying that the magazine consists of a work of as an archive is a useful half-truth, because what it does is it asks the reader to try to make these connections that we're not always spelling out, although there are elements where clarity happens, I promise. So it is about artistic practice, but it's also about the viewer's practice. Hence, proposal number 27, which we commissioned for our third issue, in which you can take it out of the magazine and do anything you want with it, make it an artwork or frame it or hold it up in front of your living room floor like I did here. And us making our logo a temporary tattoo so you could turn yourself into your own issue of Pastelogram if you so desired. And that's all I really had to say, and I'll hand it off to Alexander. Those are just some things for later.
Okay, thanks. And thanks so much to Terry for inviting me or for inviting Triple Canopy. And okay, so I'll start by getting into Sina's hedgehogs and foxes comparison. I think Triple Canopy is composed of around 15 people, many of them hedgehogs, many of them foxes. And so maybe together we are both as well. Although if we are to have something analogous to Dante's Christianity, that everything we do passes through, it's probably our interest in the politics of technology and how it relates to cultural production, and an interest in especially in challenging the sort of dogma of internet boosterism and Silicon Valley ideology, and that has a lot to do with our, I mean, that's maybe like an interest or a critical perspective that has emerged since we began 5 years ago. And so similar to Cabinet, we sort of began without a coherent sense of what we wanted to do beyond start a magazine online because we didn't have money for print and because we found like a total lack of rewarding cultural experiences online, even though at the same time more and more of us were looking at art or reading literature online, and it was becoming not just like a way of a secondary mode of representing work, but rather like the site of our primary encounters with work, and often the only way in which we encountered work. And so we wanted to address this issue and work with artists and writers who might not otherwise think of the web as an appropriate context for their work and find a way of doing that. So a lot is, I guess, I think our thinking on our work has evolved a lot over time, and I guess we can get into that later. But ultimately, we wanted to slow down the internet, which also means slowing down or trying to stymie the way in which the internet seemed to speed up many other aspects of our life and of our lives, and increasingly colonize every aspect of our lives. So that has a lot to do with the reading and viewing experiences we hope to engender through the design of the online magazine. It also has to do with the way in which we work with artists and writers, which are generally long like collaborative processes that start at the conceptual phase of a project and last anywhere between 3 and 12 months. And it also has to do with trying to find a way to afford a magazine and also a nonprofit with the time and space to really think hard about something over a long period of time, and in a way that actually engages with or maybe even creates a public for that work. And to us, that also seemed a vast amount of time seemed essential to that. And I actually don't know how long that's been. So maybe I can talk very briefly about some historical precedents we were interested in. Basically, our sort of prehistory starts with the advent of the New Media magazine in the 60s. This is Aspen, which is probably the most important touchstone for us because it to us seemed to change the way that magazines functioned, rather than being, I mean, others did this before, but this crystallized a lot of changes that we were interested in. Rather than being pages in a bound magazine, Aspen was presented as many different kinds of material in a box, which changes the way in which the information or the content circulates, and it also so the material support for a publication changes, but also the context in which the publication exists changes. So rather than going to a newsstand and buying a magazine, you might go to a record store and buy a book, or go to a gallery and buy a record. So that also seemed to us like a kind of radical shift in the way in which a public might be created around a magazine. And another influences the conceptual art of the 60s and 70s, which increasingly cited artwork within the pages of magazines. This is a work called The Domain of the Great Bear by Mel Bochner and Robert Smithson. It was published in Arts Magazine. And so I guess in one issue of the magazine especially, we sort of sketched out like a genealogy of what we do, which kind of starts in the 60s, but goes through the 90s with experiments with such forms of publication as cassette tapes and boxes. This is Blast, which Jordan Crandall did in the 90s, and the like almost immediately obsolescent new media, such as like laser discs and DVDs published by the Voyager Company. And So like the idea of creating the public around our work is almost as important as the work itself. And that seems like public can seem like a sort of notional idea, but I think we've more or less experienced what it's like to do that. And so these are some of the forums in which we've tried to do that, from New York to Berlin to Sarajevo. And much of that work increasingly ends up in book form. And so we've sort of gone from internet to book as a way of critiquing technology in part. And maybe I'll just end by reading one quote by a historian who's been of interest to us, Walter Ong, who said, once the word is technologized, there's no effective way to criticize what technology has done with it without the aid of the highest technology available. Moreover, the new technology is not merely used to convey the critique. In fact, it brought the critique into existence.
Okay, that's a perfect segue, because what I was hoping you could talk about first, I've just broken this down very simply because I have a feeling that I have so much intelligence over there that I just throw something at them and they're going to make it brilliant. So, Alex ending talking so much about basically the form and the format that Triple Canopy has taken. This, and he touched a little bit on the influences, the history that they looked to when they were deciding on the form that their particular endeavor would take. But in addition to the histories, and certainly Ariel and Sina, if you want to talk about that, you're welcome to. But in addition, I really want each of you to lay out the various components and structures of your what I think, and this was my attraction, just how innovative each of you are, and actually how different each of you have decided to tackle the problem of how to present yourself to your audience. The thing that you do have in common, and I would love it if any of you wanted to talk a little bit about your thoughts on this, is just how exquisitely crafted each of your operations is. That seems to be a critical component, and it's so good you can miss it. It's invisible, which is how I know that you must give a great deal of attention to it. You all have some online presence, so if you could talk about maybe the variations on that. And there is a programmic component for some of you that I think expands the conversation. This could also cover your titles if you want to talk a little bit about, because this, where I'm saying form and format, I also just, what I'm asking is, how are you presenting yourself and kind of why? Sina, I really would like to start with you, if you don't mind, to talk about, for one thing, I'm interested in the fact that I read, I think on your website, Immaterial Incorporated, a.k.a. Cabinet. So if there's anything of any relevance to that, anything of interest to that, I'd like to know a little bit more about your title. And then also the way yours is the kind of most committed print publication. That is predominantly what you are as a magazine. And but I'm really interested in the way you've structured it. You know, the way you start with columns, inventory, et cetera, and the way you lay it out, and sort of what the purpose of that is. Mm-hmm. Do you mind talking about that a bit?
Sure, I'll give a brief. So in terms of the name, when we first started, we thought that we would do a lot of different kinds of things. In fact, the first two things we did were not the magazine. It was a radio broadcast between here and Serbia, between New York and Serbia, that was live in both cities at the same time. And the second thing was a conference on Robert Smithson. So already from the very beginning, we knew that the magazine was just one thing we wanted to do. And back then, we thought that the magazine's name should be different from the name that we use for all the other things. Soon, we found that people were saying to us, Immaterial Incorporated already did this thing that you're talking about. They're like, no, we are Immaterial Incorporated. So it turned out to be a disaster in terms of gathering up everything we've done in under one name. So we dropped Immaterial Incorporated as a name that we actually used in public. It's still our nonprofit's name, so our grants go out under that name. Originally, we wanted a kind of a very anonymous, possibly scary-sounding foundation So the Parallax Foundation was one name that we had. Material Incorporated, we like the kind of paradox of it was immaterial, but it's also incorporated. So we like the kind of theological weirdness of Immaterial Incorporated. But none of that worked. Nobody ever got it. We didn't get it, so we dropped it. So that's where that name sort of died. Thank you for resuscitating that from the depths and the bowels of our website.
On your website. I'm sorry.
No, it is. It is. And the name Cabinet, we also had a lot of different names. It'd be great to have the magazines speak honestly about the first names they thought about, because you can really see. Yours is a company, right?
Yeah, we publish an annual anthology, and one section of that anthology is foundational correspondence, which is just sort of a way for us to explain the origins of the magazine and also embarrass ourselves in public. And so we started out as the New Hungarian Quarterly, which is sort of charming. There was no real reason for that. I mean, we tried to justify it, but should I just jump in and explain Triple Canopy's name?
Yeah.
So since we started in 2007, which was the sort of the peak of war in Iraq being handed over to private military contractors, and as we were trying to figure out what to call ourselves, I came across an article about this hot new firm that was kind of taking over where the disgraced Blackwater had left off, and they were called Triple Canopy. And we thought that was such a beautiful name being used to such terrible ends that we basically wanted to take it back. And Triple Canopy refers to the densest kind of jungle, where there are three different layers of canopy, and which also produces the richest kind of ecosystem because it contains moisture. So it has a nice kind of poetic resonance with what we do, but also we wanted to take it back from the real Triple Canopy.
Was Blackwater too much of a reach?
Blackwater seemed like we would be it seemed like we would get a cease and desist order immediately. And at this point, Triple Canopy seemed like small fry still. Uh-huh. But we do occasionally get queries by people who were seeking employment with Triple Canopy or have problems with and want to assault people who work for the real Triple Canopy. So, we direct them to the other one.
Did you resolve that in some way by having Canopy, Canopy, Canopy? Was that just a clever?
Yeah, that was a safeguard.
Because their website is canopycanopycanopy.com. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but if you search for Triple Canopy, we've overtaken the other Triple Canopy now in terms of Google.
Good for you.
Google results.
Mission accomplished.
So we're going to call it quits.
It happened. Well, do you want to talk, Ariel, about the title Pastelogram, and then maybe everybody can talk more about the form and format?
Sure. I had a lot of really bad ideas. Since everybody else brought out their dirty laundry, I'll mention some of my ones. Art on Parole was an early option. Look, it's art. There were some pretty, I had some other good ones to tell you now. Blanked out on them, but
this really demystifies the whole process. Isn't it?
I have a tendency towards bad puns, and I was reading this letter from Marianne Moore, who's a modern poet of some repute, and she'd been asked to suggest a whole bunch of car names by the advertisers for Ford. They thought, who better to come up with a name for a car than a poet? And so these were names for what ended up being the Ford Edsel, which is not a name that she suggested, but there was this amazing list, Varsity Stroke, Utopian Turtle Top, Chaparral, Bullet Cloisonne.
What? Where can we get that list?
You know, it's online somewhere if you just search.
Varsity Stroke sounds like a crime.
Pastelogram was almost named Varsity Stroke because of its crimely nature. You might have noticed from the cover of our third issue that we kind of like crime, or at least illegality. So Pastelogram was one of them, and I liked that it was a poet coming up. One, it's a quote, which we do a lot, and two, it was not for anything really that special, is for a car, and it was a total joke, which seemed appropriate at the time, being an art history student trying to start a magazine. And it also, I think, in kind of the broad range, it was a word that didn't really mean anything, but that there was this long story behind it. And Pastelogram is kind of about falling down the rabbit hole and seeing what's behind, you know, these kinds of abstract pieces or things. So that's it.
That's Pastelogram. Yeah. Can each of you talk just very briefly, because I want to get to your choice of content, but about, for example, Triple Canopy has began online for the purpose of slowing down the internet and creating this horizontal read. And I know that's kind of old hat now because you guys are moving on. But could you talk about that initial decision, because that's the way you presented yourself initially, and then what you've learned in the process and therefore the changes you've made?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure. So we started using a very simple side-scrolling format. So our major innovation was that you would read by moving from page to page horizontally rather than vertically. And that was actually, I'm forgetting the name of the old, HyperCard. So there's an old computer program called HyperCard, which uses this format. So it's actually like somewhat outmoded way of reading, but we thought it to be a good alternative, to the vertical scroll, which to us seemed, to like inevitably lead toward distraction. And that way of reading online was actually developed so that coders could sift through content, which is to say that it was never meant as a way of reading rather than regarding information in a somewhat distracted manner. So we used basically the metaphor of a page, which in some ways was rather novel at the time, but is also quite obviously retrograde. Mm-hmm. as a metaphor to go to a website where you don't really have anything to look at except for one little card with either an image or text or a video on it. And so the reason we did that was basically to concentrate the reader or viewer's attention on pieces of content. And so we very quickly, developers put together a content management system that made it very easy for editors who had minimal experience with HTML to design projects using that template. Obviously that has a lot of constraints, which we realized fairly quickly. And after 2 or 3 years, we decided to update the site and switch to a column-based template, which allowed for text and images and videos to flow through or alongside one another much, much easier. And this is also a matter of internet protocol making it, and the way in which browsers are updated, and the way in which the technology changes over time, making it more or less impossible to effectively control the viewing or reading experience without constantly fussing over the details and checking, checking how a layout looked in three browsers and just never being able to get it right. And then a week everything would change and it would be wrong again. So, we, which ended up meaning that we were doing almost as much work as you would to lay out a book. So we decided to switch to a more flexible format, not necessarily because we wanted to, but because of the dictates of the protocol or the medium in which we were working. So, and then, that too had many constraints, especially as, as a template, it's made for long form reading, and it's, you can only do so many things with work that is, image based or video based. And so, now we've basically done everything we can do that is interesting to us within those constraints. And so we're developing a new publishing platform right now that will have 5 or 10 templates. And so it will be much more accommodating to different kinds of literary and artistic work. And also, in that time, we've become more and more interested in working in print and doing artist editions and not necessarily pushing for every project to be web specific. And so I think with this next iteration of Triple Canopy, the platform will be very much web specific in as much as it will be able to coherently represent projects that assume many forms and many mediums and also illuminate the relationships between them. But the work itself will not be so fixated on being particular to the web and the tools that you can use on it.
So you've come to the conclusion that the idea needs to drive the format.
Yeah. I mean, also we were dealing with this problem of slowing down the internet, which I think is now being solved in some sense by major corporations with right. hundreds of millions of dollars to throw at that problem. And we're not going to win that fight. And it's also, the companies that are doing that are doing it so that they can have people spend more time reading or looking at something, which makes advertising more valuable so they can extract more value from the interaction that somebody has with that content. And so we want to do something that it sort of exists outside of that. And so now our new sort of tongue-in-cheek motto is slow down everything. Yeah. Or no, slow down the world. Sorry. slow down the world.
Or everything.
I don't know. Whichever you like best.
We can vote on it tonight.
Yeah.
Okay. You can go back because I think that this might be the same question, just under a different subtitle. I want to kind of talk for you to talk about your objectives. With that, of course, that has a lot to do with the way you present yourself. So maybe, Sina, in this, you could talk a little bit about those different, the way you've divided the magazine up. I'm still really interested in everybody kind of hearing about that. If they're familiar with Cabinet, they already know this, but I'm interested in the thinking behind it. Why you divided it up the way you have. Every issue, there's a color, and every issue. I'd also like for Ariel, for you to talk about how you started 2 years ago with images and sources, and you talk about it kind of spanning past and present because you have the artist doing what they're doing, but by an art historian or writer talking about the sources, you're connecting it to the past. But how that has also, now you're more interested, has changed because you're more interested in it being informative but maybe less didactic so that the reader's making the connections. Then we'll go from there. So, Sina, you want to go ahead and talk about those
sure.
divisions?
So people who don't know the magazine has four columns. So there are six or seven columns at the moment, and they take turns, but some of them are always there, like colors, for example, which has been there since issue one, where we assign a color to a writer, and he or she cannot haggle. They just have to take the color and write about it. To a column called Inventory, which is about list making or registers or catalogs of various kinds, etc. There's one called Ingestion, which is somewhat about food. And Then there's a section called Main, which is unthemed, and there's a section which is the theme section, which I kind of, you know, what ends up on the cover. And it's been maniacally the same since issue one, which is 12 years ago. And in some sense, and also the design of the magazine has changed, of course it has, but not that much. So to most readers, you know, who are casually looking at the magazine, I think they would think that the first issue and our current issue are basically laid out the same. There have been tiny tweaks here and there and little experiments that usually we dropped and went back. So it's been very, very consistent in some sense. And there, one of the reasons why this has been this way is that there are logistics reasons for this, but we'll come back to those. They're not that interesting, maybe, except for people who actually make things. But one of the reasons why we're interested in this kind of totally anal uniformity in design and shape was that the magazine has a lot of different kinds of materials in it. It's stuff that might have ended up in an academic journal, next to a prank, next to an interview with somebody who is a specialist in some sense. They're not an intellectual in a traditional sense, but they work on, let's say, they catalog the soles of shoes, and they have created an enormous catalog of every single sneaker sole in the United States, for example, is somebody we interviewed. And these kinds of specialist knowledges live next to what you would normally and traditionally recognize as an intellectual. And so there's such a variety of voices and kinds of writing. And we wanted to basically produce a coherent shell that allows the reader to be fooled into thinking that there's coherence here. So
it works.
Does it work? Okay, good. So we felt that if the articles each try to express what that article's little world is like using different kinds of fonts and design, and each issue was different from the other one, the variety of stuff would fall apart, and it would look like something that people would give up on. Whereas, in fact, we don't think that anybody on the planet will find every article in any issue likable or enjoyable or of interest. We hope that most people would like 60% of it. That's just a fake number we put out there, but that's what we say. And we're hoping that some of those things that they'll end up reading, there are things that they didn't think they would be interested in without this ruse of uniformity. So they'll end up reading, they'll go, oh, I'm interested in the notion of the enemy. But then in the unthemed section and in the columns, they'll end up reading about four or five other things. Let's say the little bones that fish have in their heads that guide them to where they're going, which is a magnificent structure and can be read in lots of interesting ways. And they'll end up reading about that despite the fact that they didn't think they were interested in it. And the uniformity is a way to kind of produce a sense that it's okay, you can read this too, and pull them in. So it's a kind of ideological ruse, basically.
Beautiful. That's exactly what I'm looking for.
Now that everybody knows.
Yeah. Just the people in this room, and we'll keep
That's
it
right.
on ourselves. Ariel, would you talk a little bit about your sort of shift from... I'm really intrigued by the idea of that you're... the Pastelogram functioning as an artwork as magazine or magazine as artwork, but that you kind of had this shift in terms of just how much information you give the reader and how much participation you're wanting from the reader now.
Right. You know, I'm not sure if it was... I mean, I feel like that requirement of reader participation was always there. Mm-hmm. And it's only later that I came to realize it. What we've done with the print and online issues is usually it requires a very close collaboration with an artist, a lot of talks over beers, basically. And, you know, sorry, let me... collect my thoughts. Some of it, a lot of the sources actually come from what the artist told us
right.
was important for them. In terms of the structure of information in the magazine, I do try to have, or Pastelogram tries to have moments where things are pulled together a little bit. There's the editor's statement, which usually offers one thread that might be taken through the magazine's text. And then there's always an interview with the artist, either by me that or another editor or somebody that the artist wants to interview. And that those should be perhaps more explanatory moments. So there's kind of moments of expansion and compression that happen throughout the magazine. In terms of our style, in kind of opposite from Cabinet in some ways, mm-hmm. each one is very different right. in size, format, design, even font and layout. And a lot of that came up when we worked on Ricky Yanis's issue. Mm-hmm. So our first issue with... I guess I could flip through here. Our first issue with Barry Stone, that's what I was thinking was going to be the pastelogram format. That's it on the left. And then when Ricky wanted a magazine that kind of almost became Time, in fact, the original cover looked like a Time magazine cover with the red border and everything. And then I did a little research and realized we'd get sued if we tried that. Particularly, it's that red border is trademarked, like the yellow border of National Geographic. And I wasn't too worried about getting caught, but I also didn't have the money to save myself if I did. So I talked Ricky into flipping the colors. But if you look through that magazine, you'll see that the font is identical to Time's, and the way we've laid out some of the page structure is very close to how Time magazine did it. And it was to do that, to kind of mm-hmm. be of Time magazine, but also trick mm-hmm. a little bit. Then with Johan Zetterquist's issue... Barry and Ricky were both artists who lived in Austin, so it was possible to talk to them pretty often and have them there while we're designing the magazine and talk to the designers and things like that. That was not really possible with Johan Zetterquist since he lives in Sweden and his English wasn't always so great. I'm sure Swedish is excellent, but I don't speak Swedish. And so that actually required much more coming in on the part of me and Cece Marsh, who was the co-editor on this issue, to, after the interview with Johan, take a couple of things that he said and then go and try to find things that we thought would work. So some of that is revealed in the magazine that this is slightly different from the first two. And I decided doing that it still worked in the pastelogram mission, even though I can't really argue that what's in number three is an archive, because it did this in terms of asking the reader to connect the dots. So though the cover is, it's a work by Johan called Disobedience, where he snuck knives on airplanes and then photographed himself carrying the knife. The body of the magazine is actually his proposals for public art, and we put those in tandem because we wanted that flavor of crime to be understood as part of these perhaps less criminal proposals. Does that answer your question?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, so it very much your format would be driven by the artist you're working with, and
yes.
so it makes sense that each of your issues would change, whereas Cabinet has... taken this similarity and used it as a device that I think is really effective right. for them.
And so Pastelogram ended up a little bit halfway between a zine, a magazine, and a book, mm-hmm. which is also not something I understood at the beginning, but I'm starting to work around now.
Yeah,
I appreciate that you're learning as you go. I imagine anything worthwhile is that way. I want to talk about content. Alexander, can you talk a little bit about the content in Triple Canopy, how you come up with it? I mean, I understand that, for example, with Pastelogram, a lot of content, like the format, is going to be driven by the artists they're working with. And Sina's talked a little bit about how the content works, how at least it's structured and who he goes to or who the magazine goes to for the various articles. Can you talk about the choices you guys make? I'm really kind of struck by the fact that there seems to be this real focus on the culture of the internet and the nature of the internet and so forth, but that most images we see is all these people sitting around a table. I kind of like that we're kind of understanding that scope of these are people making decisions about what is going to go on the internet and how to use the internet for your own purposes. Can you talk about some of those? I mean, I can only imagine the sessions that, you know, what are we going to include and why?
Yeah, they're long. I mean, it's actually changed a lot over time. I think initially we didn't have such a clear sense of the kind of work we wanted to publish and why. And you know, occasionally we'll publish thematic issues, and so we will we'll have conversations about why we are interested in a particular subject and how we want to address it and in which forms, and then we might get in touch with certain artists or writers to pursue those ideas. But quite often in the past, it's more a matter of the interests of various editors, and each editor has been more or less free to pursue projects that she is excited to work on, and that's maybe changing a bit in the future. I think most of the people who work on Triple Canopy are not paid employees, and for it to be satisfying over a longer period of time, I think that they need to feel like they are getting something very significant out of it, both in terms of their knowledge and their social interactions, but you know, especially in terms of the satisfaction of like working on a project that enables you to think really hard about something over a long period of time. And so when we relaunch the magazine in September, we're going to be primarily devoted to issues that address like a particular question or subject. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of what we've been doing in the last 3 or 4 months is meeting as groups of editors and putting together reading lists and doing a lot of reading and together and discussing these subjects at editorial meetings, and then thinking about which writers and artists we want to work with. And so that's like a shift in the model from a more traditional editorial model to like a Triple Canopy doing this kind of collaborative creative research, and then finding the people we want to work with to articulate those ideas. I mean, you mentioned that like, the people thing. I often envy what Cabinet is able to do in terms of structuring a reader's experience of diverse articles or project, in a sequence that consists of magazine pages, where and in doing so to provide like the illusion of coherence, or to actually create coherence, especially through the editorial process, because that's something you can edit with or against. And Triple Canopy has always we publish we don't publish an issue of the magazine at once. We publish an issue over the course of a month or 2 months or 3 months, and so it becomes very difficult to indicate to a reader why one project might relate to another project, and why you might continue to read, and why like your experience of one might be enriched by your experience of the next. And so part of why we do that is because we can't really get our act together to publish an entire issue at once. And also initially we thought that this rhythm of publication and of circulation, where we are sort of like making noise constantly but still publishing in a way that is punctuated in the same way that like a conventional magazine publishes, would encourage readers to come back regularly. And we found that isn't really the case,
right.
Which is partly why we're working so hard with our new website to really like indicate to people what the relationships are between different projects that we've done, and like, provide a very like clear sense of how they might benefit from reading, you know, five or six things rather than just one thing.
You mean people don't come back, you know, as you publish over the course of 2-3 months, people don't come back again and again? Is that what you were
saying? Yeah, I mean, readership increases slightly when we are actively publishing an issue, but really it spikes most severely when something is posted about on other websites. So, and it's, you know, that is also why we've focused so much on doing, like, having conversations in public that have to do with the work we're doing in the magazine, and on, like, creating a coherence between those activities, because that, like, actively, you know, creates a public or an audience for the work, which we have kind of struggled to create online, or it's maybe it's just that it's much more abstract online. Like, we don't have subscribers so much.
This is a slightly, I'm not sure you can tell me, just shut me down if this is not at all appropriate for the three of you, but it strikes me that I'm clearly very enamored with what you do, but I'm also interested in the fact that you all work with artists in some capacity, and, you know, obviously Pastelogram is doing their biennial print issue as a work of art with an artist. Triple Canopy, you're collaborating with artists in really meaningful ways, which maybe during the question and answer we can talk about a little bit more. And then Cabinet has artist projects and the postcards and the bookmarks. So you're all definitely engaged with artists. I know there's this one Cabinet where Alejandro Cesarco did this beautiful piece, The Inventory of Memory from Every Issue Prize. So you're interacting, you're all interacting with and working with artists and producing things from artists. But, there are plenty of people in the audience tonight who will relate to this. There are a lot of artists who are doing writing these days, and I don't think this is new. I think this goes way back. But I'm kind of interested in how it seems to have sort of spiked, and it's either because no one else will do the writing for them, or they don't feel like that people are going to represent it well or whatever, or it's part of their practice. You know, Frances Stark is very funny as she talks about how she had somebody lined up to do this essay in her book of collective writings, but then they backed out, so what was she going to do? She took the advice of this LA writer who said that, you know, artists need to encouraging artists to enter into this discourse. So she decided to get a lot of different people to write an essay. But what she did is she then fed them the questions. You know, it's just this kind of funny, you know, she's very self-deprecating. That's part of the work. That's part of the humor in it. But it's kind of this sort of intentionally showing how pathetic it can be for an artist to try to have their work written about, or for there to be that kind of conversation. You have R.H. Quaitman that writes, until relatively recently, working at a slight distance from institutional affirmation has shaped my practice, which I think is a really beautiful, funny, and profound statement. She says, if you don't have a book, make one. If you don't have a writer or historian, become one. This is just something that artists are doing more and more. And, you know, Greg Bordowitz in his Volition Book of Questions, he asked, is it possible to write like we think, moment to moment, day to day, year to year? And is it possible that the job of art is to give everyone concerned, the artist, viewer, critic, collector, an ethical part in creation? So we're all doing this for ourselves. And then if you go back, you have Lucy Lepard, who was a big advocate for the writer, the critic, getting in there. If you're going to report about groundbreaking work, you have to be there when the ground is being broken, you know, that kind of attitude. Conversation a few years ago with Liam Gillick when he was here, he was really lamenting that there were no Lucy Lepards now. How is there going to be any documentation on what has happened? I don't see any of your you approach art writing as review or criticism. In fact, I kind of see what you're doing as works of art in and of themselves. You might, like you were saying, Sina, you might say that Cabinet If you found some of those articles in, say, a science magazine, it would look like, in fact, reporting on the subject of the topic. You know, it would look like a report. But being in this magazine that's really framed by art and culture, it's sort of a piece in and of itself. I mean, it's sort of the place. I mean, it's all about the place where you're finding that sort of shapes how you view it. Do you guys, again, this may be way off track, but do any of you have any thoughts on art criticism? Like, where is it now? What do you see its future being? What is the value? How does it differ from what you're doing? Could you just speak to that for a few minutes, and then we'll close by talking about audience, how your audience is, and then we'll open it up. But just any ideas on art criticism, review, documentation?
We decided very early on that art criticism was not going to be in the magazine ever. And so we would go to artists, ask them to do projects. They would write about their own projects. And part of the idea with all of that was that this idea of critical distance and a certain kind of judgment that comes with that, that is supposed to come with that, that whole apparatus was something that we were not interested in. Mm-hmm. We found it, to be honest, there are a lot of places that do it. They do it well. We found it tedious as an exercise. We found it demoralizing, and we thought that we should reject it completely. So we've never had a review. Artists write about themselves. Mm-hmm. If they really don't want to write about themselves in their introduction to their artist projects, we'll write it. We'll write a text, you know, about the project. But it's not art criticism. It's really about all the interests and all the fascinations that went into the project. Whether it might end up looking like a piece of anthropology or sociology or whatever it is. But it's really about the research that goes into the work rather than looking back and going, as artwork, this is what, you know, how do we judge this and what's the right distance to take on it in order to judge it. So we're much more interested in the studio wall and the productive and, you know, unruly tensions that are there between text and image, and that mess of stuff is sort of what we would like to try and get into the magazine more, as opposed to the finished work that is there as a way of, as I said, for us to then judge it in some ways. When we first started the magazine, we had my wife's an artist, and we talked to a lot of artists, and one of the co-founders of the magazine was an artist, and we found that basically a lot of artists don't read the long essays in the art magazines. You know, they do read the reviews. If a friend's interested, this is a huge caricature, but you know, but it had some truth to it. Freud says only the exaggerations are true, and then let's just go with that. So, and we found that those long articles that, you know, Art Forum publishes, they're not of huge interest to lots and lots of artists. Some artists are interested in them. Of course they are. But we found that their reading list didn't have that as a vital part of what they were reading in order to make work. And I'm not saying it has no value, but we thought there must be other ways to think about art making and to make that studio wall come into the magazine rather than take up this critical stance, you know, where we set ourselves up as, aha, we can judge this. This is good. This is bad, you know, and that sort of mode. Again, that's a bit of a caricature, but
That's very good. Thank you.
Well, Pastelogram actually does reviews. We have them online. And I agree with Sina that it's sometimes tedious and disheartening, but sometimes, not always. I wanted to do reviews. Part of it was the situation in Texas at the time that Pastelogram was created. ArtLies had just gone out of business, and I thought something else was needed, and I knew I was pretty good at editing reviews. So I figured, why not? But I also think that review writing is an extremely powerful vehicle for the writer to learn how to start writing about art, how to start describing, how to think about their own relation to the work, what their own opinion is in contrast to what the artist is perhaps trying to do as or what the artist says they're trying to do in their statement, but maybe the reviewer isn't seeing it. And those kinds of interesting tensions are all things that can come out in reviews. So I love them. And I agree that the long-form essays and art form are not, well, they're virtually unreadable. Now you know what I think. Anyway, one of the problems, at least with a lot of the contemporary art criticism I've read, is that it's not always very clear. And a lot of it's very jargony, and it doesn't need to be. If you go back and look at some of the art criticism of the past, I know Clement Greenberg's is every... Sorry, Clement Greenberg is everybody's favorite whipping post, but he was a great writer. Jill Johnston is an amazing writer, and the form of her writing did had something to do with the forms of the works that she was looking at. And so she was really thinking very carefully about the art of description in terms of genuine relation to the work. I shouldn't use the word genuine, but a closer relation to the work. So we started doing reviews online because we thought it was a little faster, that it might be a better document. But because we can't pay review writers, often we'll try out an inexperienced writer, and then it takes me 3 weeks of editing a 500-word thing to get it to where I want it. So like I said, disheartening. Anyway, we're going to still do them. But
I apologize because I did know you did the reviews online. I was thinking of the printed publication. But yes, you do. Of course you do. And do you have anything to add to that, Alexander?
I mean, I think a lot of the people who work on Triple Canopy are interested in magazines like Avalanche from the 60s and 70s that... really allowed, like, sort of for the first time, artists to take control over how their work was represented to the public and diminish the authority that was held by, like, a few elite critics at magazines like Art Forum. And, you know, not every artist wants to write or should have to write. You know, we tend to be interested in artists who are concerned with language and integrate language into their practice in some way, maybe not always in like an instrumental way and certainly not always to describe their own work, but who are interested in language as a form of, as material for their work and also as a way of articulating what they're doing or what they're interested in. And I think maybe we consider like publication to be something that is in between, or that is both like a critical project and like an artistic practice, or that can contain both of those, and so do the work of criticism without the judgment involved. Not that criticism shouldn't continue to do its work, but like this book that we just published, Corrected Slogans: Reading and Writing Conceptualism, which was our contribution to an exhibition called Postscript: Writing After Conceptual Art at the Museum of Contemporary Art in Denver, very much uses publication to encompass or digest a lot of public conversations we had at our space in Brooklyn, and to really like address the legacy of conceptual art and poetry in a critical manner, but in a way that really enacts some of these ideas rather than just straightforwardly explaining what they have to do with art today. And so it's many of the conversations at those events are transcribed and heavily annotated here, but we've also commissioned essays, but not really critical essays. I mean, one of the essays is in the form of a Yelp review of the symposium. So it brings that internet specific language to bear on the project. We've also commissioned, we have documentary photographs paired with somewhat absurd poetic statements by a poet who was writing them without having actually looked at the photographs. So, you know, I think ideally what we do can be art and criticism at the same time.
Hmm. Well, that's beautiful. That was more than I could have hoped for from that kind of risky question there at the end. It occurred to me as I was thinking about us doing this that, you know, everything I loved about what you guys were doing really had nothing, to my mind, to do with, it had more to do with sort of an artistic act in and of itself than maybe criticism. So thank you for engaging me on all of that. And with that, I'd like to open it up to questions. I'd hope to give you a full 20 minutes, and I have left you with 10. But I think that it's important for you guys to be able to ask the panelists your questions. Yes, ma'am.
Krista.
Yes.
This relates to what was just being said, because you guys have said a lot about your relationship to commercial publishing and art form just got mentioned several times. And I'm wondering not just what your relationship is to commercial publishing, but what your relationship is to the academy, or what you see your relationship to be to scholarly publications and peer-reviewed publications, because I see a space opening up within publishing where these two audiences can maybe come together and bypass certain limitations.
For Cabinet, we have, you know, we're a quasi-academic enterprise in some weird way. I'd say about a third to a half of any one issue has articles that have been contributed by academics. Sometimes they're writing in ways that you wouldn't recognize them to be academics, and sometimes you would. This article could have been published somewhere else in Tone or whatever. We're not peer-reviewed, which makes a difference in terms of the kinds of risks that we can take, although I think the whole peer-review system is kind of maybe changing quite a bit at this point. So, but, you know, we are huge. We listen to the Academy as seriously as we can, with as much time as we can. And one of our goals to begin with was to think about the role of the public intellectual in America, and especially how academics have now slowly, the language that they can wield has become atrophied because of the lack of spaces in which they publish outside the academy. So that jargon that sort of comes in more and more into academic writing, I don't think it needs to be there. You can read like late Edward Said or Michel Foucault, and those are incredibly complex arguments given in ways that anybody with a BA can understand, really, because it's all beautiful and simple and, you know, supple. So one of our goals was to be one more venue where academics could slowly kind of, you know, step out of that kind of insular mode and try different things. And we work hard with them to make sure that the language, I hope, I'm not saying pieces in Cabin are always easy, but I'm hoping that they can be, you don't need to be a PhD in the particular field they're in to get it, we hope. So we would like to be a bridge between academia and something, I don't know what it is, journalism, I'm not sure what it is, but we're very, very, that's very important to us, for sure.
Did anybody else want to address that?
I feel very similarly to Sheena about how Pastelogram thinks about the academy and scholarly publications. Again, I mean, we're not peer-reviewed either, although we have a lot of academics on staff and on our editorial board who are looking through these essays and determining the strength of their arguments and the strength of their writing when we commission such texts.
So. Yeah, I mean, maybe the pertinent thing for Triple Canopy is that we like we don't want to slow down things so much, and academic publishing is pretty slow. And I think in order to create like a more reflexive circulation of texts that, you know, enables someone to have an idea and work with an editor and get it out there in a few months, and then for there to be a response, and for that to stimulate further conversation that maybe finds its way back into the magazine, you need to be like more light on your feet than most academic publishers are capable of being.
So there's slow down and then there's slow.
Yeah, there's slow down and then but you know, that said, many of the editors are academics, and I hopefully Triple Canopy is able to digest much of what is happening in academia, and present it in like a somewhat less academic form of writing.
Okay. Sally?
I was just wondering if because of the fluidity of sort of what you all do, if you see these, what you're doing as sort of projects that are sort of framed in time, so maybe this will go on as long as it goes on, and then it stops and you do something else, or if this is, because yours has been, is 10 years old, correct?
12.
So I just wondered if you see it as having a beginning and an end.
We did to begin with. We thought we would publish for 3 years just because we were told that with the $80,000 we'd raised, we couldn't go past the first year. So we thought 3 years just to prove that we can do it. And then we, you know, I don't know, we kept going.
You failed.
Yes. So a couple of weeks ago, we had a discussion around, and Freud talks about this father in one of his books about this father figure who's dead but doesn't know it. And we were thinking, when do institutions die without knowing it? I mean, you know. And someone should tell them, listen, you're dead. Some benevolent younger publication. So it's a good question, and I don't have an answer to it. But, you know, at some point, you know, we think of ourselves as like, it's still a struggle. We have a full-time staff of one, me, and two part-time people who come to the office. It's still a struggle, just like it was day one in terms of time and getting things done, and it's always a mad struggle. So that makes us think that we're still not an institution, but it's not true. We're an institution, and we have, you know, we've bought a space, and we have a certain presence, and we have a blah, blah, blah. So, you know, negotiating your fantasy of yourself, you know, especially that when that fantasy is... has some reality in the sense of like the labor that goes into it and the, you know, mom and pop kind of sense of the whole thing still, and then the external sense of you, which is, you know, oh, it's an institution and an old one now, 12 years, you know. That's a very difficult, I can't answer it, but it's definitely a very good thing to think about, and I don't have a, you know, don't know how to answer it.
Yeah, I mean, for Triple Canopy, I think many of us, at least initially imagined that like this wouldn't last forever, and certainly many people have cycled in and out of the project. I think it's like it's essential to us to be making pretty dramatic changes to what we do every few years in order for everyone to remain interested. And that is like maybe why we seem somewhat fixated on the form of what we do. Or our approach to publishing, you know, things feel somewhat self-referential at times, but I think that is, you know, ultimately productive in as much as it keeps us from becoming complacent. You know, that said, the ability to keep doing this is totally contingent on whether you can build a structure that can like actually support the labor that people put into it. And you know, we've gotten better at that over the years, but we have quite a long way to go. And you know, that said, it seems like increasingly daunting to try to find other work, or like impossible to find a full time job that you would be excited about for many of us. So it does, in that sense, seem like viable to try to build Triple Canopy into an institution that can actually pay people decently to do things that they're very excited about doing. But that remains to be seen.
Other work is terrifying.
It is. Yeah. Does it even exist? No, it does exist.
Pastelogram, well, we keep the budget very, very small, which has enabled us to keep going on what started out as my savings, which are now gone. You know, we did manage to actually break even last year, but we still can't pay staff or pay our review writers, although we can pay artists and feature writers a little bit. So in terms of growth, I don't think it's going to grow a huge amount over the next 2 years, because my focus at this point is being able to pay writers and staff when we can do that. But it would be nice for it to keep going, because it's not an immediately apprehendable thing. It actually, the idea is something that builds over several issues, I think. I mean, we haven't even fully got into it yet. But the way for us to keep being able to do this is to keep it fluid. Everybody that works on it, you know, gets their money from other gigs, and maybe one day we'll be an institution. But until then, we're going to, you know, basically would it limp along financially. And, you know, so far that's working out fine. I mean, nobody's really suffering too badly. So, yeah, that's...
Noah?
I just had a question about the tension between, like, the local and the global. I know that Errol mentioned that when Costellagram started, there was this particular context in Texas in terms of our writing, but that we had talked a lot about the importance of keeping it global. And also just Sina mentioning the first instance with Cabinet having to do with Sarajevo, and then this recent event at Triple Canopy having to do with international art English, which sort of opened up all of these global questions. So I'm wondering how you deal with those tensions, like a specific local audience in relationship to a global readership.
Yeah, I mean, that's always been a really difficult question for us, and we haven't really figured it out. Maybe this is most ironic for Triple Canopy because so much of our work has been online, and yet we we are like very much focused on New York, and we have like an international readership. But you know, I think that is in part because we've found that like it's really fulfilling to have these actual interactions with people in New York, and that makes it seem like the publishing work we're doing is like truly meaningful to people, and that's rewarding. And it's much harder to have that palpable connection if you're trying to reach a global audience. You know, that said, something we're trying to do in the next year or two is to have regular events, discussions or projects having to do with issues of the magazine in a few different cities around the world, where we have editors and where there are other institutions that we feel sympathetic or some affinity toward. But yeah, there's no easy answer to that question there.
Yeah, we've never thought of ourselves as a New York institution, to be honest. I'm sure we are, because just who you bump into, who you get to read, who you start to, like, you know, think about. So I'm sure we are. But in our self-image, we never thought of ourselves as a New York institution.
But isn't Cabinet, like, extremely popular in the UK?
It's more popular in the UK than the US, yes. It is. And, you know, we're now currently thinking about moving the magazine out of New York completely. And there are many things to think about in doing that, but the idea that that would somehow change the magazine for the worse or change it fundamentally, that's not a factor that at least I am thinking about. Maybe my colleagues will feel differently about it, but it may go to San Francisco next year, and I don't think that'll change it at all, to be honest. Some more San Francisco writers will end up in there. In terms of... sorry, there was something else you said at the end there. You were talking about...
other cities?
What's that?
Other cities?
Oh, right. No, I was on a funding panel a few years ago, and a book publishing company, a very well-known one that a lot of you would know, had come up for funding for the Department of Cultural Affairs, which is the city-level agency in New York City that gives, you know, money to. And somebody on the panel said, you know, they don't really have a community. This is a book. They publish books. And I was like, are you kidding me? That's a community. And they're like, no, because, you know, community means people meet and have relationships that are face-to-face in some sense. And people sitting alone all over the country, and this is a very important book publisher, it's changed my life, reading these books and maybe in syllabi in some elite universities, that's not community. And it was shocking to me, but we had that long argument about this, and we just about managed to convince
the rest of the people. The books produce communities too. Communities aren't just about, you know, the conversations that happen at cabinet space and triple canopy space, etc. But there is still this sense that, you know, there's something a little wrong about that kind of virtual community of readers, you know, whether it's online or in print. And I don't know why I mentioned this, but there is a kind of an inbuilt bias towards that. That doesn't answer your question, but I thought I should mention that.
Well, for Pastelogram, we started in Austin, which is, not to say anything bad about Austin, but considerably less cosmopolitan than New York. and so it was necessary to try to think about having editors spread out across the country, which we do. And when we first started, we had a few in Europe, but then they inconveniently moved back to the States, so that didn't work out for us. At the same time, being in Austin affects who's on the staff, and also some of the problems that, you know, sometimes we see in the art world here, particularly some of the worries we have about Texas jingoism, perhaps is a good way to put it, do affect the kind of reviews or things that we think about, because it's the things that the editors or the main staff kind of is dealing with every day. And of course, it also affects very pragmatic things like funding, grants, who we're working with, what fairs we participate in, and what our intellectual community is like. So,
Can't you have editors in American cities that sound like they have European names? Like Athens, Georgia, Paris, Texas?
That's a really good idea. I did think about trying to do concentrate all of the reviews on kind of second cities, like Boston, Chicago, I guess Miami doesn't count, but maybe Atlanta, and like paying no attention to New York and L.A. And then I realized I'd kind of be shooting myself in the foot, so that... Although it could be cool.
I hate to do this because I'm getting some hands now. Everybody's really wanting to ask questions, and I apologize, but it is about 10 minutes later than I said. I promise we'd get out of here. So I invite you ask your questions, to come up and ask your questions. And also, you might have noticed the tables out there. There are examples of each publication, some issues from each publication for you to look at. And if you want to sign up to be on a... some kind of newsletter or list or something. I think both Pastelogram and Triple Canopy have a sign-up sheet, and there's an extra sign-up sheet, but I wasn't sure what Sina wanted me to do with it. So you can just write Sina a note or something. Whatever. Okay, thank you very much. I love that we're closing with the jumping beans.
Thank you, Terry, for organizing this. Thank you, Terry, for organizing
this. Thank you. It was great. Mm-hmm.